Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In 1977, Terry Harrington was captain of his Omaha high school football team and looking ahead to college. Then he and another black teen were arrested for the murder of a retired white police officer across the river in neighboring Iowa. Harrington spent 25 years in prison before the Iowa Supreme Court overturned his conviction. The court said key evidence in the case pointing to another suspect had been withheld. Harrington is looking to sue prosecutors for framing him for murder. That case is now before the U.S. Supreme Court. This hour, On Point, Terry Harrington tells his story. You can join the conversation. Can you imagine spending 25 years in prison framed for murder? What's your question for the man who now wants to sue? Should the prosecutors be immune? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. In a moment, we'll hear from Terry Harrington. Joining me first from Washington is Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor and legal correspondent for Slate. She's been covering the arguments in the case before the Supreme Court. Dahlia, thanks very much for being here.
Hi there, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Would you be good enough to remind us of the facts of this case, Dahlia?
I think you hit the low points. 1977, two African-American teenagers, one is Terry Harrington, the other Curtis McGee, were arrested for the murder of a former police officer who was a night watchman in Council Bluffs, Iowa. They spent 25 years in jail before it became evident that two of the prosecutors in the case had failed to turn over key evidence that would have exonerated them. Among that evidence was evidence that the original suspect in the case was seen by witnesses at the crime scene, that he failed a polygraph test, which meant that he was certainly should have been a key suspect for a lot longer than he was. The star witness in the case who had fingered Harrington and McGee initially fingered several other people, all of whom had airtight alibis. The star witness was a 16-year-old who was cooperating with the prosecutors in order to get a better deal in some other criminal matters he was facing. The star witness named the wrong weapon when he initially talked to the cops. None of this was turned over. Prosecutors have an obligation to do that. None of it was turned over. The police had questions throughout about whether or not they were going after the wrong guy. Nevertheless, all of this stuff really remained under wraps until Harrington befriended the prison barber, and the barber started to do his own investigation. And lo and behold, eventually, the Iowa Supreme Court said, we have to throw out these convictions. But as you said, that was 25 years later.
And so 2003, he's out, but that's a lot of years behind him. We're going to speak with Terry Harrington today. It's not every day we get to speak to someone who's been through something just like this. I mean, this was, a night watchman at an Oldsmobile dealership in Council Bluffs, Iowa. He was found dead on the nearby railroad tracks, apparently killed by a shotgun blast. Another man had been seen with a shotgun in that area, a white guy, that night. As you say, he failed the polygraph test, but just moved on anyway.
Well, and one other key point that I didn't mention is that Harrington and McGee were black. The other suspect was white. There was Council Bluffs, Iowa. It was a sort of principally white community, and there was this real racial undertone. At least that's one of the arguments that was made at oral argument last week by Paul Clement, who was representing the two African Americans, that these prosecutors really wanted to nail someone, and that there was this ugly, ugly racial overtone here that really, really does, I think, suggest that there is a civil rights violation that happened. In addition to a right of freedom, there was a racial right that was violated here as well.
Now, Terry Harrington, who we will speak with momentarily, is out of prison. So is Curtis McGee. So it's not to get out that they have a case before the Supreme Court. What exactly is the case that's come before the High Court, Dahlia?
They brought suit against various state officials who were implicated in what they say was this frame-up under Section 1983 of a civil rights statute. And so what they're essentially saying is, we want these guys who took away our freedom so cavalierly, we want them to be on the hook. The reason the issue comes before the Supreme Court is that there is a longstanding tradition that while police officers have, quote, qualified immunity from this type of lawsuit. That means some behavior is clearly unconstitutional and police officers can be on the hook for it. Prosecutors are not. So this turns on a very technical question about whether prosecutors have what's called absolute immunity from this type of lawsuit. And the sort of longstanding tradition has been that for the most part, prosecutors are completely immune. There's been a question about whether prosecutors could be immune either from work that was done long before trial that looks a lot like police work, or if the prosecutor, if the evidence is not introduced at trial. So if, for instance, the prosecutors are involved in a frame-up, but then the evidence is put in a drawer and not used at trial, then the court has said, well, if it's put in a drawer, we probably can't go after those prosecutors. This is a case in which the prosecutors were involved at a very, very early stage with the police, and moreover, the evidence that they found was not put in a drawer. It was used to send these guys away for 25 years. So that was the question. The court was really testing the limits of prosecutorial immunity, and I should also just add, Tom, that the reason we generally say that prosecutors are immune for everything they do is because the argument on the other side is they would otherwise be sued under Section 1983 every single time a guy goes to jail.
Well, that was the argument of the defense last week for these two Pottawatomie County prosecutors, David Richter and his deputy, Joseph Herval. Their defense said, this is Stephen Sanders saying, you know, if they don't have this prosecution, he said prosecutors will do nothing all day but defend themselves against meritless litigation.
And that the argument was pressed even further in the second part of the argument. The United States Solicitor General's office was in on the case, and Neil Katyal, the Deputy Solicitor General, went even further and said prosecutors, if they are open to this type of lawsuit, are going to be chilled from bringing vigorous cases. Anything that kind of looks like it's on the line, they're not going to do, and they're going to become so defensive, so terrified of future lawsuits that they won't be able to do their jobs. I will say there was one other concern that was brought up by Justice Stephen Breyer, who is one of the most liberal members of the court, who said we want prosecutors to cooperate with the police at the earliest possible stages of an investigation. And if the prosecutor isn't in on it because he's worried about his hide, because he's worried that he's going to be culpable in a lawsuit, then we're going to have police doing all sorts of misconduct without a lawyer there to watch it. So even some of the liberal justices, I think, were quite concerned about the idea of opening prosecutors up to this type of suit.
And what's being sought here is Terry Harrington and Curtis McGee want to be able to sue these prosecutors. That they're looking for a green light from the Supreme Court to do that, Dahlia.
That's precisely right. They say there has been no repercussions for these two men, that what they did was way out of bounds, and that for them to be completely immune from suit, for them to be able to walk off scot-free after Harrington and McGee spent 25 years in jail is simply unconscionable. And their attorney, Paul Clement, really said the whole point of Section 1983 of these civil rights statutes is that the government cannot use their authority, their massive prosecutorial authority, to cook up false evidence and send people to jail. That's a cornerstone principle that if we cannot protect ourselves because some people are simply immune from suit for whatever they do, then what's the point in having civil rights statutes in the first place?
Dahlia Lithwick, please stand by for a moment. Terry Harrington joins us from Omaha, Nebraska. He was 17 when this murder took place in 1977. He got out of prison in 2003 after 25 years. Mr. Harrington, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Did you follow closely the back and forth in the High Court, the Supreme Court last week? What did you think, Terry?
I thought it was absolutely amazing that you can adopt a theory that is you don't have a freestanding right to be framed for murder in the United States. I mean, I think it's just absurd, you know, for someone to feel that they can just do whatever they want simply because they're in a position. And that's exactly what happened here.
What about the prosecutor's argument, their defense argument, that if your case is allowed to go through, every prosecutor in the country will be looking over his shoulder, afraid he'll be sued every time out, and, you know, the criminal justice system will grind to a halt?
I disagree with that. I firmly believe that in order for a person to bring a lawsuit, they have to have concrete evidence to make sure that their points stand. And when you violate the law, when you do something knowingly, then you should have to look over your shoulder, because that ghost will come back. You know, the truth, you know, lives forever. Lies is what don't stand. So if you're concerned about your actions, then you should really take the time to do the right thing from the beginning. Otherwise, in the end, it'll come back and bite you, just like it's doing right now.
Terry Harrington, we look forward to hearing your story in this hour. Dahlia, before we let you go, what does it look like before the court on this case? Can you see how the court's where the justices are likely to come down? Is Mr. Harrington's case likely to be successful here? Can you tell?
It was very hard to tell. As I said, part of it looked like a typical 5-4 split that you and I have talked about many times before. But we did see Justice Breyer and possibly some of the other liberals on the court very anxious about, as I said, knocking prosecutors out of those very, very early investigations so that the police are essentially untethered from any legal advice. And I think any solution that's going to make Justice Breyer happy is going to have to account for that. So this is going to be difficult even for some of the court's liberals. But I do think that the court clearly was struggling with the notion that, as Mr. Harrington said, what they were going to do if they voted against Harrington was create, quote, a freestanding right to be framed by a prosecutor. And that certainly rankled, I think, many, if not most, of the justices. Mm.
Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor, legal correspondent for Slate, following the Supreme Court always and last week. It's always great to have you with us. Thank you for joining us today, Dahlia.
Thank you so much for having me, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Terry Harrington, the man framed for murder at 17, who spent 25 years in prison in Iowa, whose case is now before the United States Supreme Court. Terry Harrington joins us from Omaha, Nebraska. Mr. Harrington, where you were, 17 when this all began to unfold? You'd been a high school football star, headed with college plans, and not a perfect angel. You had a car theft on your record already.
Not a car theft.
Oh, but set me straight. Give it to us just right.
At the time in 1977, I did have a felony pending, but it wasn't for auto theft. What? It was for driving a car for a friend of mine during a robbery.
And then here comes this. By the time you were 18, you were in the big house, really in prison.
Literally.
What was that like?
It was devastating. I mean, the downward spiral was just, you know, unraveling. And, I mean, I'm trying to make sense out of what's going on. I'm facing charges for a crime I knew in my heart I didn't commit. And to be pursued, you know, in a situation as such is just mind-blowing.
You had an alibi for the night of the murder. Your high school football coach stood up and said that you were with him at a concert, an outdoor concert in Omaha. That didn't fly with the jury?
No. I mean, my attorney put him on the witness stand. You know, really, the night of the murder, I was at an outdoor concert in Peony Park here in Omaha, Nebraska. Mm-hmm. And it's literally 15 miles from the crime scene. And at the time that Mr. Schwer was being murdered, I was face-to-face with my high school football coach. And we was having a conversation. You know, I got benched after the first couple games of the season because he told me he expected more from me. And because I wasn't playing up to his standards, he put the guy in who was an underclassman. This was my senior year of high school. Mm-hmm. You know, and I had strong aspirations of getting a football scholarship in my mind. I thought I was good enough to go to college to play football at some level. And he benched me, and he told me he expected more from me. And, you know, it was just kind of heartbreaking for me, so I quit the football team, you know. And that night was the first time that I actually talked to him after the football season, because I graduated from high school early, mm-hmm. a whole semester early. And I just waited to walk across the stage with my class in June. And when I saw him in the middle of July at the concert, we talked. And he explained it to me. And that, you know, was closure to me for what he did and why he did what he did. So it was about a 25, 30-minute conversation. And little did I know, those 25 minutes would, you know, be the cornerstone of my whole life.
When did you realize that you were facing a murder rap.
In early October of 1977, I got arrested in September 30th as a fugitive from justice, and I was being held for Dodge County, which is Fremont, about 30 miles from Omaha, as a for two counts of auto theft. I had no idea what they was talking about. I've never stolen a car in my life, never been in a stolen car, and I was being held without bond.
This was in relation to the break-in at that Oldsmobile dealership in Council Bluffs that night?
No, sir. This was in relation to another auto theft, or two auto thefts that guys, one of the key witnesses, the guy who made all these outrageous statements at the beginning, him and another friend of his was arrested in two stolen cars. And when the police arrested him, they asked, where did he get the cars? And he told them he got them from me. So that became a basis to arrest me. So they arrested me September the 30th. October 3rd, I was taken to Fremont to face two counts of grand theft auto. And about 4 days after I got there, Pottawatomie County officials came over to ask me about a murder. And about October the 7th was the first time I actually heard about the murder.
The Iowa Supreme Court has essentially found now that you were framed. Did you have that feeling at the time? I mean, if this wasn't something you knew about, then clearly something was off the rails. But could you see something going on? Or, you know, you were 18 years old. Did you understand what was happening?
I didn't understand what was happening. You know, the basic premise of life in the United States is, you know, you're innocent until proven guilty. So, I mean, I believed in the system at the time. You know, I wanted to study business law or psychology, one of the two. And it became, well, if you're innocent, they have to prove you guilty. And I just felt like there was no evidence to any, you know, pointing me to the crime, so I wouldn't be concerned about it, you know, eventually. But as time went on, little did I know it, they had their own ideas of what they wanted to do.
25 years is a long time. I wish you'd take us back to those. It's an unbelievably long time. Anybody who sits and contemplates it, you know, it's almost impossible if you haven't been through it. Take us back to those first days when you were in prison and really understanding this is life sentence without parole. What mental process did you go through to take that on board?
I was numb. I didn't know what to feel. I didn't know how to feel. I cried a lot. You know, and I just prayed. I believed that God wouldn't leave me in prison for something that I didn't do. And just the whole course of time, you know, from the day I walked out of the county jail, you know, after I was sentenced to life without parole, I went to one of the worst prisons in the United States. You know, I was 18. I just turned 19 years old. 4 days after my birthday, they found me guilty. And within 30 days, I was locked in a maximum security penitentiary. You know, where a riot had happened literally 30 days before that. I went to a lockdown situation. You could see the filth. You could see, you know, just the lack, you know, or the uncaring people around you, you know, with no basic form of understanding of life. You know, everything was just in disarray. It was like a war-torn area in a third world country. You know, they were still trying to piece the penitentiary back together.
What prison was it?
Fort Madison, Iowa State Penitentiary in Fort Madison, Iowa.
You were crying every night. I mean, our sense of prison is that doesn't go down very well.
You don't let people see you cry. You know, it's not like I was, you know, crying in front of anybody. Every cell there is a single man cell. So once they close the doors and they lock everybody in, you know, you and your pillow get to know each other. You cry, you plead, you do whatever you have to do, you know, to maintain some sense of understanding. And you have to keep a strong upper jaw. I was the youngest person in the prison I was in. And, you know, I created an alter ego. Terry couldn't survive in a place like that. I was too outgoing. I was too, you know, I felt like I was too popular. And, you know, when I was going to school, but in a place like that, you want to fly under the radar. You don't want to be popular. You don't want people talking to you. So I had to create an alter ego. So I became TJ. And that's who protected me. You know, I had to do what I had to do to get out of prison. And by any means necessary, I know that's a cliche, but survival of the fittest, and I needed to be strong.
Meaning, TJ, when you walked outside that cell door, when you were with the prison population, this was your, what, tough guy persona, your tough guy alter ego?
Well, it was my keep-to-yourself persona. You don't get in people's business. You don't let people talk to you about theirs, and you don't talk to them about yours. You just, you know, go through day-to-day, however you have to survive. I was there literally 24 hours, and I had to arm myself to protect myself. I bought a knife, and I had made up my mind I was going to make it out of there in one piece. And however I had to do that, I mean, it's sad to say, but that's how I felt.
You bought a knife in prison. There was a market in knives.
You could buy anything you want in prison if you got money for it.
We want to hear much more about your story, but we have listeners who want to talk with you, Terry Harrington. Let me go first, if I may, to Niagara Falls, New York. And Miguel, Miguel, you're on the air with Terry Harrington.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to say that I think the prosecutor should pay for what he did. And nobody should be worried about prosecutors being afraid of making a case, because if the prosecutor isn't qualified to make the case properly or to find the proper person, the culprit, then he shouldn't even be a prosecutor. And that's what that'll eliminate, people that are unqualified. And it'll also eliminate the possibility of people like Mr. Terrington, I believe.
Harrington, yes.
And Harrington, I'm sorry. And myself, well, I was arrested one time for stealing a car I'd never even seen in my life. I never stole in my life. I pride myself on that, and that really hurt me a lot. And a friend of mine that I'm sure a lot of people also heard about, Tony Capozzi in Buffalo, New York, that just got out of prison recently for doing 25 years for crimes that he didn't commit as the bike path rapist. And that kills, another thing to eliminate is the killing of a person's incentive to abide by the law.
To do right, if the risk of being convicted when you haven't done wrong is there. Miguel, thank you very much. Let me get one more right here from Iowa, Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Mark, you're on the air with Terry Harrington.
Hi, Mr. Harrington. I want to apologize to you as an American citizen. I think this is just outrageous, and I just wonder and admire, actually, your lack of passion about this. I guess maybe I don't know how you've endured it. But to me, I just am so impassioned about this because I don't understand where the outrage is for a citizen's right to walk around without fear of unjust persecution. That's what this is about. Sure, we must find a system that balances our need for prosecutors to be able to do their job. But ultimately, the social contract is about Americans, citizens, black or white or whatever, to live life and enjoy liberty and freedom. And to err on this side is just such a shame. And I just really am sorry for what you had to endure. As a black man in Iowa, this racial factor as well, I hope that we'll explore that deeper, because it is a factor here. It's not just an American story, but more specifically, it cannot continue.
Mark,
I'm actually speechless.
We hear you loud and clear, and let us pick those up, and thank you for your call. Terry, let's look at two things, race and then rage, and whether you felt it. I mean, you sound so level-headed today. I want to understand how you came to that, but it was an all-white jury. You were a young black man. Did you then or over the years come to see this as primarily a racial story? After the man who had been seen with a shotgun, who had failed the polygraph test was that night, was white. I don't know what the facts of that night were, but did you see this as racial or something else?
But Tom, allow me to say this. I didn't find out exactly who this guy was with the dog and the shotgun until 22 years later. I mean, the day that I got arrested, the day that they came and, you know, basically surrounded my mother's house and took me across, you know, to jail to hold me for the Council Bluffs authorities to extradite me across the state line. I sat in jail wondering, you know, why me? You know, why me? I didn't know about the man and the dog. I knew, you know, at some point during my trial that they talked about a man and a dog, a man footprints and dog prints by the body, and that it was a fresh set, and it was two sets. One was fresh. The other one was kind of old. Mm. They took plaster casts of the body, I mean, of the footprints and everything, the dog prints. I didn't have a big dog, you know, and it really didn't dawn on me that they knew who this person was.
This was a guy who was married to the daughter of the fire chief in town.
Exactly. Mm. I just knew it wasn't me. So when they talked about the man and the dog, they said they never found him. They never knew who he was, when in fact they knew because they gave him a polygraph test. They consulted an astrologist about this guy, you know, and They never offered me a polygraph test. They offered everybody involved a polygraph. Some, you know, the majority failed. They never even came to me and asked me would I take one. You know, I didn't know. I couldn't feel anything other than rage for a long time. You know, but you get to a point in your life where you have to turn it over. And I prayed a lot, and I firmly believe that's what got me through. You know, for the first 12, 13 years, I was so angry. I got stomach problems from stress. I almost died in prison because of the stress. You know, I have Crohn's disease, which is, anyone know, it's an emotional disease. You know, you sit there and you contemplate different things.
Stew.
And you know, it's real bad ulcers. Your stomach just produces so many bad chemicals, and I lost probably 45 pounds in 30 days. I got down from 185 to 140 pounds. I found myself in the hospital with tubes all over my body, worried about dying in prison. That was my greatest fear. Not so much from, you know, physical altercations, but just from being there. You know, there was people who had been in Iowa prison for 45 years, and they wasn't even thinking about letting them out. You know, and here I am 15, 16 years in, and I'm trying to get out for a crime I didn't commit. You know, they didn't care. You know, the parole board strictly deals with issues on paper. And the last time I saw them, and I know I'm jumping back and forth, but the last time I saw them was 1994. And they tried to get me to admit that I had responsibility for the crime. And I told them I didn't. And they told me until I accepted responsibility for this crime, then they wouldn't see me again. I never saw them again because I wasn't going up there to go through that again. So, I mean, it became kind of ironic that, you know, eventually after everything came to light, that the same people who told me they wouldn't even consider letting me out of prison until I took responsibility was the same people who the governor put together and told them to find a way to get me out of prison. So indirectly, they realized I did not commit this crime.
Did you look at this in those years as a racial injustice or not when you were in prison?
In the end, I did. But during the course of it, I knew Council Bluffs was predominantly white, 99.5% maybe. There was one black on my jury, and she excused herself within the first 15 minutes of the jury selection. So I had to deal with what was there. And, you know, in my mind, I just didn't feel that I could be found guilty for something I didn't do. Regardless if it was black, white, orange, green, or whoever, the facts would speak for themselves. Little did I.
From maybe that low point, what you described, when you'd lost all that weight, you were ill, you were facing maybe even death, how did you come back from that? Where did you find the strength to survive this thing?
Through God. I prayed. I prayed that if I made it through what I was going through, I would change my thoughts and my ideas about life. And that would be forgiving, you know, those who was responsible, you know, for putting me where I was. I mean, I had to start with baby steps. Don't get me wrong. It wasn't like I just said, I forgive everybody. You know, because you can say it, and if you don't mean it, God knows. So when I said it, I started living that. I started forgiving those people in my mind over and over. I prayed for them. I prayed that the truth would come out, and I prayed that they would tell it. Don't try to help me. Just tell the truth, because the truth literally would set me free. It was not me that was, I mean, that committed this crime.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Terry Harrington. The man framed for murder at age 17 spent 25 years in prison in Iowa. His case, the case where he's looking to sue for being framed, is now before the United States Supreme Court. And at the heart of it is this issue of whether prosecutors have immunity, have full immunity, absolute immunity, when it comes to their work in criminal cases. He joins us today from his home in Omaha, Nebraska. Eric is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Eric, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom and Mr. Harrington. First, I want to say to Mr. Harrington, I send you my admiration and apologies as well. But the fight you are conducting is really very important. The Supreme Court has to know, and as they discuss this case, they have to understand, this is really the tip of the iceberg. These cases are hidden by prosecutors. I was a public defender in Seattle some years ago and had a case where the prosecutor hid evidence in the case. We caught him, and the police detective, whom he told to lie, exposed him, and the jury acquitted my client. And then he went on to do it in another case, the same prosecutor. So this is a network that is protected by the law. And I think you can understand, and your listeners can understand, if prosecutors have only an incentive to hide evidence or to invent evidence and no strong disincentive, then many of them will continue to do so.
Well, as in serial offenders in the business of framing, you're saying you saw.
Well, you can understand that when police and the FBI go after somebody or they're looking for somebody who committed a crime, they go after the first people they look for are people with records. These records are hidden because they never come to light. There are prosecutors who do this repeatedly, and they are given no disincentive. The argument as well that police should be liable for their missteps, but prosecutors not, is actually a ridiculous argument, and it insults all of us. Prosecutors are the ones who are most educated. They're the ones who have been to law school, and they're the ones who as well take oaths when they become lawyers to behave a certain way.
But the argument is this is a murky business, it's a messy business, you know, criminal cases and trial, and there'll be a chilling effect that prosecutors won't feel free to go to vigorously, you know, pursue justice if they have this hanging over them, Eric.
Tom, it's not a murky business. The Supreme Court said in Brady versus Maryland years ago that prosecutors have a duty not only not to hide evidence, but to divulge evidence that could tend to show innocence. They have an absolute duty. Mm. This is not a murky question. People who say that it's murky or the prosecutors won't be able to do their job are just hiding the issue. They're obscuring it. That's absolutely not true. I would love to hear anybody call in, any prosecutor, and explain why this is a murky business. Prosecutors know what they're doing. They have standards that they must follow. Those standards are actually written out in every state. And this is not a murky business. It's a clear business. It's a difficult business. Mm. And the ones who do the job well deserve our admiration. But the ones who don't, and the ones who purposely, we are now talking about purposefully hiding evidence or creating evidence or putting somebody in prison for life or worse on death row.
Eric, I appreciate your call very much. And Terry Harrington, let me put it to you. What are you looking for in your suit against these prosecutors? Are you attempting yourself to create in some personal way that disincentive for prosecutors to frame?
Well, you know, my position is such as vindication. You know, I was labeled a murderer. I lived a life of a murderer, regardless of whether, you know, I actually committed the crime or not. I had to go through those circumstances. And, you know, I agree with the gentleman who just spoke. You know, prosecutor's job is not merely to prosecute the guilty. It's to protect the innocent. And, you know, to do a role, you know, sometimes you have to walk a tightrope. You know, but while walking that tightrope, you have to pay attention to the details. And the details should never, you know, allow you to muddy the water. You should, you know, take the path of least resistance when necessary and do your job. And your job is to make sure that innocent people do not go to prison. You know, one of the most helpless feelings that I've ever had is when I stood before a judge for a crime I knew in my heart I did not commit. And he told me a jury found you guilty, not a jury of my peers, because there was not a face that looked like me on my jury. You know, but the jury was all white, male, female, middle class, probably farmers, probably, you know, college students. You know, those were people who, you know, for whatever reason, believe that they needed someone to pay for their fallen hero. And I just happened to be that person. Any black man in the United States that I look back on this could have stood there and it would have been the same verdict. You know, so when he's sitting there getting ready to pronounce his sentence for the crime that I have been allegedly or undeniably found guilty for, he asked me if I had anything to say. I had written him a letter. And I told him in that letter that I did not commit the crime. I did not, you know, feel that I was judged, you know, by the content of my character, you know, but by the color of my skin. And he sent that letter back to me. And when he asked me if I had anything to say, he told me now would be the time for you to read the letter you wrote me. Mm-hmm. And I read it. And, you know, the irony of that situation is at every level, 22 years later, 23 years later, the Iowa Supreme Court used that letter in reference to the fact that they withheld evidence, the fact that they told the witnesses what to say, and it became, he told you 23 years ago he did not commit this crime. He said he would keep fighting until he cleared his name, and now he stands before us with all of these issues, you know, that he accused you of, that you said didn't happen, and they're exposed. So, you know, it happened at the Iowa Supreme Court, it happened at the United States District Court, and it happened at the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. They referred to that letter. I mean, I didn't write it for future references. I wrote it to try to halt the injustice that was happening to me at that time in my life.
But that didn't happen. And last week, before the Supreme Court, or at the Supreme Court, Chief Justice John Roberts said, again, though, that his concerns are about the chilling effect on the prosecutors. His concerns seemed on the other side of this equation.
I feel like that should be the least of their worries at this point. What they should be more concerned about, and I'm not trying to grandstand or anything, but I really feel like what the concern should be about is that people should not be framed for murder. You know, a prosecutor should do their job, and if their job means dismissing charges, then that's what they should do. If it means, you know, participating in an investigation to find the real culprit, that's what they should do. It should not be anything happening underhanded. The water, you know, if it's clear to begin with, it can't be muddied. You know, it can only be muddy when you do something underneath that water. As long as you're gliding across the top, you don't touch the dirt. And you have to stay focused on what your job is, and that is to make sure innocent people do not go to prison.
I want to bring into this conversation right now, if I may, Douglas McCullough. He joins us from San Francisco. He's a member of Terry Harrington's legal team, civil rights attorney. He was in Washington last week for the oral arguments. Attorney McCullough, thank you very much for being here.
Tom. Hello, Terry.
How you doing, Doc?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
What do you make of the way this is unfolding so far before the Supreme Court, Mr. McCullough? What did you hear in the arguments and the court's response last week?
Well, I've been listening to your other participants as well as the call-ins, and I think that we're going to prevail in the Supreme Court. You know what it ought to be? It ought to be a 9-0 decision. There shouldn't be any question at all about whether a person has a freestanding constitutional right not to be framed. I can't even imagine why there'd be a struggle in this country about such an issue.
But we've got Supreme Court justices last week expressing a fair amount of concern about just that question. And I mean, you may not have any question about it, but they apparently did and do. How do you interpret that?
You've touched on some of the issues about the chilling of a prosecutor and his obligations and the fear that the prosecutor may not vigorously pursue his job. There are so many hurdles and so many protections that a prosecutor enjoys. From the moment that a complaint is filed, the courts take a look at that complaint, and they dissect the complaint that's been filed, and if it's not factually specific, they can throw it out on that basis. Then there is discovery, and there's motions for summary judgment. We've been through all of those things before, so Terry, I can't even remember how many levels of courts we've been through at this point. But each one of those courts look at what the court has done before and what has been presented in order to protect prosecutors. And so the idea that they're going to be chilled in their job, to me, is a false notion.
We've got a call from Concord, New Hampshire, maybe from a prosecutor. Irene, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes, thank you. I'm actually a prosecutor in Massachusetts, but I'm not speaking for my office.
Mm-hmm.
I have had cases and I have worked on cases where an innocent person has been convicted and then exonerated. And I want to say that for all of the prosecutors that I know, that is the very worst thing that can happen to us. I understand from Mr. Harrington's case, that the evidence seems to suggest that this was an intentional act by prosecutors, and that is a horrible thing, and I am sorry to Mr. Harrington that this happened. I'm also sorry to the two people who are accidentally convicted of crimes they did not commit. But I wanted to say that sometimes this discussion becomes a way of saying that it's better said that we all should be looking for the truth, and I believe that is what good prosecutors do.
But Irene, what if it wasn't accidental? I mean, the case that's being brought here by Curtis McGee and our guest Terry Harrington is that they're suing the Pottawatomie County prosecutors, claiming they coerced and coached witnesses, fabricated evidence, arrested them without probable cause. That doesn't sound accidental.
It doesn't. Without having studied the case, I would hesitate to give a comment. If those things were done, that sounds way beyond the pale to me, and it would seem like a terrible thing. And again, my apologies to Mr. Harrington. If that is truly what happened, that is a horrible thing.
But if the Supreme Court goes in favor of Terry and Curtis, do you fear as a prosecutor that you would be vulnerable? You say, you know, it's happened to you. Innocent, an innocent convicted, then exonerated. Would it have a chilling effect on you if the court goes in their favor?
My personal feeling on this is that I don't believe it would have a chilling effect because way before I get to the fear of being prosecuted myself for something I'm doing, I don't want to put an innocent person in prison. So I am trying really hard to make sure that never happens. And so I don't need a law that says I'm going to get in trouble because I want the truth to come out. I want innocent people to be acquitted. I only want guilty people to be held responsible for crimes that they actually have committed.
Irene, we're glad to hear exactly that. Douglas McCullough, is that enough? There's a prosecutor who only wants the true and right verdict here.
Right. I think Irene's right. The vast majority of prosecutors try to do their job, and they try to do their job correctly. They use everything at their disposal to make sure that the job is done correctly. That doesn't mean every prosecutor passed that test. And when you have prosecutors that behaved like they did in Terry's case, then they have to answer for that. The system fails if you don't have an answer for somebody like Terry and Curtis McGee. When you have two innocent men that were framed and sent to jail for 25 years and the law doesn't have an answer for them, something's wrong. But I think Irene is right. I think the vast, vast majority of prosecutors do their job as best as they possibly can. And for those prosecutors, this simply does not have a chilling effect.
Douglas McCullough on Terry Harrington's legal team. Thank you very much for being with us today from San Francisco.
Thank you for having me.
Mr. Harrington, have you imagined what your life, how it might have been if you had not spent those 25 years in prison during those long days and months and years? Were you thinking about an alternative, what it might have been, what it might be?
Yes, of course. I mean, I sat there every day for 25 years thinking they would come to me and any day and say, okay, you can go home, you know, and that means from 78, 79, you know, chronologically, mm-hmm. all the way up till the day that it actually happened. And, you know, my sole purpose in life was not to fail and to be put in a situation where, not of my own doing, I was basically stripped of my life, stripped of all of my profitable years, of all my, prime, for a mm-hmm. crime that I didn't commit. You know, and I'd also want to say this about Miss Irene's comment mm. is, sure, prosecutors, some do follow the law, and I'm not mm-hmm. saying everybody in prison, was framed. I'm not saying everybody, in prison is innocent. But, the bottom line is this. When you're doing things with an ulterior motive, campaigning, or prosecuting in the face of a campaign year.
Which was the case. One of the prosecutors was up for re-election the next year.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's the old boy network. Whatever you do, it's like to say whatever happened in Vegas, stay in Vegas. Well, whatever happens in, at that time, my belief mm. is whatever was happening there stayed there. So, it was easy to, target black people. It was easy to, go through situations where, well, we'll put this here. We don't have to talk about this and we'll just go. Because the assistant DA or the assistant prosecutor was, involved in the door-to-door search for the guy. But no one ever said that they found him. No one ever said that they knew exactly who the man and the dog was, you know, or that they brought him in for questioning. It was like, oh, well, we got off of that, you know, and there was just so many other things, you know, like, you know, my car was wrecked the night of the murder, you know, but no one seen the wrecked car. You know, I had filed a personal injury report to have my car fixed. A lawyer took pictures of my car at 11 o'clock in the morning. The man was killed at 12:30 that same night. It's theoretically impossible to have a car fixed in less than 24 hours. But everybody who saw the car never said they saw it wrecked.
So are you free now? Are you free now, Mr. Harrington?
Not completely. I'm still strapped to a case that's been haunting me for vindication for 32 years. And until all of this is behind me, I don't believe I can actually start living my life.
We're grateful to you for being with us today. Thank you very much, Terry Harrington, for taking the time and for sharing your story with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Terry Harrington, his case now before the United States Supreme Court. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.